Chapter 3 Garstag is still fighting. He was among the first into action, stalking down the long accessways into the starboard decks above the main gunnery spine. He took the Cardane with him, six battle brothers in the same mix of Terminator-class plate. Some is Tartarus pattern, some cataphracti, some of more obscure provenance, or no longer clearly identifiable. They carry flails, mauls, and compy bolters, clattering heavily down the crowded passages with condensation steaming from their vox grills. It was a brave decision to board Solus. The enemy must have been expecting reinforcements at some stage, for even Imperial Space Marines would not be boneheaded enough to take on a fully loaded Grand Cruiser in scattered squads. The Lords of Silence are a powerful warband, numbering more than 600 unbroken and several thousand unchanged, ably prepared to defend a ship that is more than partly alive and which harbours a vindictive streak towards its old makers. Solus was prepared not for mere raiding, but for invasion. It is equipped for decades of continuous warfare, a shipborne army in its own right. So they must have been expecting reinforcements. What happened to prevent it? What had that lurch been, and why were the lumens blown? Why is Solus so badly damaged? Garstag does not have time to reflect on that. He pushes himself back into a combat stance, shoving aside the shattered remnants of a bulkhead hatch. The Cardane are knee-deep in filth and broken metal, locked in darkness and only visible from muzzle flashes and the dark green glow of their helm lenses. This chamber is where the enemy has decided to make their stand. 20 of them, he thinks, tactical marines of the Iron Shades chapter, isolated and cut off and determined to die with honour. He does not cry out as he cuts into them. They are shouting liberally as they fight back, spewing invective and battle chants. This seems to animate them, to give their blows added heft. They are skilled and committed, moving fast even in the tight confines and plentiful wreckage. Garstag sees a space marine vault across a collapsed beam and empty his bolter into the oncoming charge of Branad, one of the Cardane, which slows his advance significantly. But they are fighting a losing battle. The very environment is raised against them. Glowing tentacles burst from the foaming water, grasping at their legs and arms. There are little lords in the rafters, and they throw themselves at the warriors with snickering abandon, chewing down on power cables and armor joints. Every time a fighter has to shake one off, it gives time for Garstag's brothers to close in and finish the task. Terminator plate gives them a huge advantage, and this is no standard tactical dreadnought armor. Like everything else, it has been changed, expanded, thickened, and mutated. Branad has a curl of sucker-encrusted hooks for a right arm, writhing like a nest of serpents. Artarian has a fanged mouth snapping over the barrel of his heavy bolter, which is linked to his body by permanent strands of glistening mucus. Garstag himself has the greatest of the gifts, a chainsword of living talons, crackling with corpuscent and dripping with ever-renewing toxins. Garstag does not attempt to emulate the swift strikes of the enemy. He trusts in his colossal ability to absorb punishment and strides through the murk in stately measure, taking hits from bolt rounds and barely flinching. The Cardane are fighting as the Death Guard have always fought, like a gauntlet closing on a throat, slowly building pressure, building and building until resistance snaps. The Iron Shade leaps out at him from the darkness, sable armor glinting, sweeping a power blade close, two-handed. He's far faster than Garstag, and the crackling edge sinks into his leading shoulder guard. Living ceramite closes over the wound instantly, sucking the sword from the Space Marine's grasp. He reaches for his bolt pistol, but Garstag can grab him now, seizing him by the throat with his claw. For a second, the Iron Shade fights back, thrashing out as his boots leave the deck. But then Garstag squeezes, a savage contraction of servos and fused sinew, and his attacker's neck is broken. Garstag throws the limp body aside, and it crashes into the blood-foamed filth. Then there is another coming at him. Perhaps he is some champion, his path cleared by the sacrifice of a lesser warrior. He carries his own chainsword in one hand and a bolter in the other. The combined assault is formidable, a punch rain of shells backed up by heavy swipes of gunning linked teeth. Garstag is rocked by it, smashed back on his heels, and forced to parry with his blade. He sees the death mask of his enemy loom out of the murk, a pair of backlit lenses like a ghost's eyes, and realizes he has miscalculated his momentum. But the enemy is suddenly thrown to one side, hit by a perfectly judged shot from an injector pistol. The dart slices out from the shadows and catches him at the neck, right in that minuscule sliver of weakness between helm and gorget. The champion reacts instantly, grabbing the barb and throwing it to one side. Garstag could strike him then, but chooses not to. There is no longer any point. Instead, he watches as the iron shade is rapidly consumed from within. A spasm, a shake, then blood fountaining from every armor joint. The Space Marine falls to his knees, vomiting through his helm's grill. Garstag can hear the fizz of flesh being eaten, even under his armor. The rest of the corpse spawn are beaten back now. They are falling away, harried on every side, pursued down the corridor by the Cardane, dogged by swarms of little lords, struck by falling spars and foaming gouts of corrosive liquid. Garstag sees others of the population joining the hunt now, which for them is really a race for scraps of carrion. Breaking out through rust-weakened holes and rents, their faces locked into desperate grins, and their eyes staring. And Slurt is there too. Strange Slurt. Odd Slurt, who is hateful but useful, and who seems to spirit into existence at the most opportune moments. The putrefier is holstering his injector pistol and looking at the twitching results of his work. His bottle-lensed helm is impassive, but his awkward body mimics the death spasms of his victim. Garstag growls at him, feeling phlegm build up in his throat, and flexes his claw. He would like to plunge his talons through Slurt and see how long it takes for the war of poisons to play out. But he holds back, of course, for he knows that the combat anger is on him, and that it will subside, and that Slurt is one of Vorx's protected, and that all these things are important.
"Clumsy, Cardane Master," Slurt says, amused, still looking at the corpse in the murk. "He would have cut your throat out."
"Why are you here?" Garstag asks.
"I've been roaming."
As Slurt speaks, a little lord plops down from the roof space and splats onto his shoulder. It coos affectionately into Slurt's clogged earpiece, and Slurt lets it nuzzle.
"This is all very unusual, don't you think?"
Garstag looms closer, his hooves splashing in the bloody, oily mire.
"Get away from me! Stay away from me! I have the just desire to slaughter, and you are now very close."
Slurt shrinks back. The little lord spits at Garstag, then darts under the cover of Slurt's cloak.
"Not nice," says Slurt. "Things are running ragged on this ship. Where are we? You know that?" "No, you know nothing."
Garstag doesn't care. He was promised a proper war, one that had been in preparation for mortal generations. These dregs are not what he came for, but for the time being, they are all he has. He can still hear fighting echoing down the accessways, muffled and dampening. He moves off, but Slurt dares to reach out, to pull him back.
"Someone activated the warp drives,"
Slurt says.
"Dangerous, dangerous. We might all be atoms now. Know anything about that, Cardane Master?"
Garstag turns on him, towering over him, his heavy helm plate pushed into Slurt's face.
"Nothing. I do not care for the ship, and I do not care for you. We have a realm before us, its back broken and ready to scour. That is all I care about. All. If you want to play games, go and find another degenerate."
Slurt laughs.
"So many to choose from,"
But Garstag has swept off, not listening. There are faint signals on his helm display, blotches of yellow in the gloom. There might be boarding parties still alive somewhere, and they all need hunting down.
"So you won't say where you were?"
Slurt calls after him. Garstag keeps moving. Vaux is returning. He has left it too long already, but there were thoughts to be thought and numbers to be considered. He has not killed, and that will be noted. He guesses Dragon will have finished many of the invaders. Garstag will have accounted for many more. Before the wrench, Vaux had even considered sending a party to seek out Naum, though he is glad now that he didn't. Naum would not have understood the situation at all. Naum is a tortured soul for all the gifts he has been given, and that is a great pity. Vaux no longer sees information flowing across the interior of his helm, as he did in the distant past, because his visor substrate is now a part of his face. So his visual field is a complex thing, a psychological layering of true vision, machine overlay, and dream projections spiked with electrical impulses from what was once a tactical broadcast implant. He cannot close his eyes, which are lubricated by a steady trickle of moisture from capillary glands. When he sleeps, it is merely a haze of torpor marching with vivid, eyes-open dreams.
"These are the ways we exemplify the lessons," he thinks. "These are the ways we shape the old faith."
He climbs back up from Philemon's cubbyhole, breathing heavily. His gauntlets grasp flaking iron and scrape across blistered synth leather. To reach the bridge again, he has chosen to pass through the sanctuary. He does not know what place this was when Solace was an imperial vessel, possibly an audience hall for visiting dignitaries, or maybe some equipment chamber hollowed out of its machinery. Now it echoes with enormity, broken up by slender columns that strike up through a jungle of vegetation. The sanctuary must be 200 meters long, a snaking gallery that threads through the belly of the ship like a bloated liver, sucking up the poisons and the swills and slowly fermenting them. Vats bubble with simmering things only to spill over into thick mulch below as their feet corrode away. Ferns and kelp tubes thread upwards into the high gallery, each as black as nightshade and pocked with glowing phosphor spines. Creatures whimper in the fetid shadows, all vectors of powerful plagues, their jaws pink with scurvy and their eyes half closed from the close press of sores. Vaux likes the sanctuary. It is a miniature representation of the many gardens of the plague planet, which are in themselves mere reflections of the one true garden. It is the closest his people will ever come to having shrines. The Lords of Silence come to these groves when they are able to breathe in the air, to feel the churn of the rotting soils beneath them. The sanctuary is disturbed then, just as all things on the ship are. Its branches sway as if a wind blows through them, and spiky leaf clusters shed in thumps. The creatures nuzzle and burrow to avoid him, so Vaux travels through the groves unimpeded, and the strands and fronds drag across his armour. He only pauses once, in one of the many dark glades, to see a fresh species of orchid pushing its head through the leaf matter. He stoops to regard it. Its stem is a virulent green, its bulbous head strikingly purple. It has sacs under its petals that shiver when he breathes on them. He reaches out with a finger to touch it and feels tiny pricks from hidden stingers folded within its delicate frame. They give him an unusual wave of pain that endures for several seconds before his physiology is able to transmute it. Vaux smiles. He will have to return to this glade soon. He may ask Philemon to categorize the orchid, to take cuttings. Slurt may even wish to use it for refining purposes. The sanctuary is bountiful. Like all such gardens, it creates more than it destroys. Nothing remains the same for long. There is always the slow creep of change. That is the thing that sets his kind apart from the old Imperium. The corpse-spawn desire, above all things, stasis. They preserve, they record, they clamp down hard on the passage of time. They are caught in their single moment, one that should have been confined to history 10 millennia ago, a moment that freezes their muscles and keeps their mouths and minds shut. It will be a mercy to end that empire, for there is no greater agony than rictus. Vaux keeps walking. Foliage tugs at him as he passes, wrapping tiny strands around his boots and kneecaps. Everything in this place would kill him, if it could. It would strangle him, render him down, suck out his vital juices, and refine them into something more diffuse. He does not mind that. It strikes him as an apt metaphor for his position at the head of this warband. He is perfectly aware that maintaining command is a matter of survival. If he delivers victories, he will be suffered to lead. If he fails, sooner or later someone will challenge him. Deposed leaders are not permitted to remain at liberty. Death is one of the better outcomes for them. He is philosophical about that. The galaxy has become an angrier place during the course of the Long War, but he does not share in its many pathologies. He can remember fighting in the Legion soon after it had ceased to be the Dusk Raiders and become the Death Guard, when his armour was bone pale and bore the marks of filth as a badge of pride. Before that, he can remember fighting and living on Barbarus as a child, and that was a true nightmare. Nothing could be as bad as that again. A scrabble for survival within a planet-wide prison that crushed the soul and shredded the nerves. Mortarion freed them from that. This is what Dragon and the other latecomers will never properly understand. Vaux is not a blind fanatic and understands that the Primarch has weaknesses, but he will never forget that first act of liberty. Unless you had tried to scratch a gasping living on the stinking white soils of that hell world, unless you had actually witnessed what the Mountain Lords could do with impunity to the cowering mortals, and unless you had seen what the Death Lord had done to free them, you could not truly comprehend. That was why the Death Guard had never fractured, for all the sniping efforts of that semi-feral Typhus and the many other rogue warlords and pirate kings. The originators of the Legion are still grateful. They will never forget, and Vaux is one of them. He reaches the end of the sanctuary and climbs swiftly up stone steps that are crumbling at the edges. The air is wet and stagnant, and the lumens are still flickering. Some are covered with flocks of moths that scatter as Vaux passes. Soon he is back in the innards of the ship and hears the ongoing efforts to make repairs and put things in order. He sees slave crew scuttle away from him and takes the grim salute of Unbroken as they lumber past in the semi-dark. He traces an old path back to the bridge, one that is sopping with moisture and overhung with grimy stalactites. When he emerges, he sees that Dragon has been busy. He has co-opted members of his own factions to secure key locations across the yawning bridge cavity. The unchanged crew take his orders without question, and they are slowly bringing the listing vessel back into something like equilibrium. Vaux approaches the old throne dais, nodding at Dragon as he reaches it.
"Siege Master," says Dragon.
The title is an old one. Other legions used to have it. The Iron Warriors, Perturabo's bitter castle builders, used it as an honorific. In the Dusk Raiders, it was more sparingly employed, reserved for fleet commanders, right up until the end of the Great Crusade. Vaux does not know if anyone else uses it in the Death Guard. He only continues to do so because Mortarion ordered him to, for unknown reasons, even though he guesses Dragon takes it as an affectation.
"I have asked the Talisman to consult the numbers," Vaux says. "This is all unexpected."
Others are coming closer now, his senior unchanged staff limping away from whatever tasks Dragon has given them and drawing up to the throne. Hovig is with them, but Vaux is most interested in two others, Drez-Ul, the Eye Smith, and Tiafa, the pseudo-navigator.
"It was a warp activation,"
Hovig starts. Her face is greyer than usual, and there are flecks of vomit on her lips.
"I know," Vaux says. "The circumstances can be determined in time. For now, we need to understand where we are."
He beckons to a servitor gang captain and gives the signal to lift the main shutters. Then he turns to Drez-Ul.
What can you tell me?
The Eye Smith is a shriveled man. His uniform is marked by strange damp patches that seem to move of their own accord, and his mouth has withered away to a narrow siphon. His eyes, as if in compensation, have bulged to obscene proportions and are showing the first stage signs of compoundification. If he survives the transition, he will end up with insectoid hemispheres that will enable vision across a whole swathe of spectra. That is not why he is named the Eye Smith. That is an older title, reserved for those who dare to apply the auger sounds to the madness of Eye Space. Drez Uil is an artisan, a skilled applier of auger and auspex to the roiling tumult of warp-void interfaces. The work has taken its toll, but he still maintains the capacity for speech, which is something.
We are displaced by several block stages,
Drez Uil says.
I am still attempting to triangulate, but it is indubitably true that we are in true void, free of the gate, fully instantiated into the physical.
Vaux draws in a long breath. There had always been an alternative possibility, that the eye had pulled them back in.
But the beacon is gone,
interjects Tiafa. Now then, Tiafa is a horror. A great-great-great scion of Solace's early navigators, she is a wretch and a twist of flesh, a stark ribcage and angular bones under a clinging velvet gown that sucks the last dregs of light out of the entire chamber. She has grey hair piled up in knots and bunches, stretched tight from her rouge skin. Her arms and neck abound with silk tresses, each covering a little bulge on her dry skin. They are all eyes, all of them closed and strapped tight. Tiafa is covered in eyes the size of fingerprints, all twitching and fluttering under their bonds and straps of faded velvet.
It can't be done, Dragan says. We're well into real space.
There's nothing,
Tiafa counters haughtily.
Nothing at all. We were warned of this, that breaking the gate would break the galaxy.
I find that rather hard to believe, says Vaux quietly.
Overhead, the servitors are hauling the shutters open in a clanging series, exposing bleary real viewers. The void looks dark and blank, but for the motes of clear starlight. There are no ink-bright clots of colour, nor shimmering demon shoals. It has been a while since Vaux has seen unadulterated vacuum. He finds it sterile and displeasing.
Well, perhaps it will come back, says Tiafa. Or perhaps we are just too far out. But I can't guide you far, not in this.
She sniffs.
Everything is broken. This ship is falling apart.
Tiafa likes to revel in an imagined superiority. She fancies she can still take on the airs of a real navigator, a member of one of the proud houses that still dominate traffic across the mortal galaxy. It is a pathetic display. Her neck would snap under a finger's pressure, and in any case, Vaux judges the long tyranny of the navigators will be coming to a permanent end soon. There are other ways of plotting a route in this new dispensation, and she is already a throwback, a mutation of a mutation, gradually being bred out into irrelevance. He doesn't say that, though. For the time being, she is still useful, and until they know more, they are vulnerable.
If you will persevere, madam, he says, that would be appreciated. Philemon will aid you.
By then, the bulk of the shutters are being chained into position, and the view is one of almost unbroken blackness. Solace is still venting from somewhere, and a thin cloud of green-grey spores drifts across the ventral field.
You have done well to restore the ship so swiftly, mistress, Vaux tells Hovig. Now we need to move again, to move purposefully, to chart a course and follow it.
To where, Lord?
Hovig asks, bewildered.
We have entered the time when all trajectories are possible, Vaux says. Set coordinates. The god will ensure they are the right ones.
He says this a lot, the god. For Vorx, there is no pantheon. The allegiance of the other powers is, for him, mistaken or wicked. There is only one genuine deified motive entity in the universe, the one that his Primarch knelt before. If that were not true, how could he commit such acts? How else could he cleave to the path that has spilled so many oceans of innocent blood? Hovig bows, awkwardly, and limps off to enact the order.
You are not here, Dragon says, his voice low.
Vorx does not look at him.
It was in hand. I took it in hand. You are my most trusted servant.
Vorx smiles inwardly. That will cut him.
You were not here.
It is becoming a habit for Dragon to repeat himself, as if that lends heft to his words. Vorx turns to face him, deliberately slowly.
They had the measure of us,
he says, matching tone of voice, so that only the two of them can hear.
Did you see the signals? They were preparing more torpedoes, gunships. They would have landed dreadnoughts. They were space marines. They might have won. I do not think. We have our orders. We make for Ultramar, just as instructed. If it takes us a year, if it takes us decades, we do it.
They face one another for a moment. Vorx is the larger, his bulk engorged like millennial layers of ocean silt, added to every year, but old now, worn into defiance by many, many lifetimes in old service. Dragon is leaner, and his body is marked by fewer gifts, but he is famished for the conflict that will earn them.
We are separated from the fleet, Dragon tries, cleaving to his line.
It will have dispersed by now,
says Vorx. He moves closer to Dragon.
There are no choices, champion. It looks that way now, but believe me, there are none. We are being shown an empty sky. That is a temptation. You see the chance for glory, to follow the mortal warlord, to carve a name for yourself. Resist it. Resist the despoiler's call. We have our orders. We make for Ultramar.
Dragon looks back at him. His helm visage is sharp, the vox grill terminating in a savage blade sweep. Vorx can sense the frustration in him, locked under pressure, like poison gas in a grenade.
You do not know where we are, Dragon whispers. You have no bearing. The Primarch is out of reach. For now, says Vorx,
clapping him on the shoulder in a gesture he knows will be infuriating.
Have faith.
He turns away. That is a profound insult within the Death Guard, for whom facing the enemy, the ally, the elements, is a cardinal virtue. There is purpose in this. Dragon must not think him weak, nor that he is out of ideas. Until Philemon can delve into the entrails of the future, there is considerable uncertainty, to be sure, but the illusion of command is not something to be cast off.
Can the cultivator fire the main engines yet?
Vorx asks.
She says yes, with some danger, says Hovig.
Then let her do it.
Vorx moves at last to the throne, where he will take his seat.
This is a new universe, brothers. A new vista. How exciting! I wish to see more of it.